Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Earlier this month, the leaders of Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela managed to settle a diplomatic crisis before it escalated into a military conflict. It began when Colombia sent troops into Ecuador to attack Colombian rebels there. The government of Ecuador said this was a violation of its national sovereignty, and the government of Venezuela weighed in on the side of Ecuador. It's questionable whether or not this might have led to a kind of a full-scale shooting war, but certainly tensions between these nations do pose a threat to the security and the economies of the region. This morning in this part of the program, we'll talk a little bit about this recent Andean crisis, and our guest for the program is Maria Escobar-Lemon. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University, and she's joining us by phone. As we talk, questions and comments from listeners are welcome. We ask just that people keep their comments brief so we can keep our program moving, get in as many callers as possible, but certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. So if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the internet in the U.S., you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 if you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, your questions are welcome. Professor Escobar-Lemon, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. And just here to get the geography a little bit established in people's minds, I suppose just the one thing that they really need to know is that the three countries we're talking about here are all together in the sense that Colombia is in the middle, Ecuador is on one side, Venezuela is on the other side. So Colombia and Ecuador share one border, and Venezuela and Colombia share another border. So And it's up in the sort of the northwestern part of South America.
Right. Colombia is at the part where Panama, where Central and South America come together, and Colombia and Panama meet. So, yes, Colombia is in the center of the two, which is in part what makes sort of this three-way conflict kind of interesting.
Well, just let's talk a little bit about the precipitating event here, at least what touched off this current crisis. It happened when Colombian commandos moved into Ecuador to attack guerrillas who were based there, guerrillas of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC,
right,
as they're known. So maybe first, just we ought to take a step back, and I'll ask you to talk for a minute about the FARC. What is the FARC?
Well, the FARC is a left-wing guerrilla organization who has a relatively long history in Colombia. They've been active for several decades. And they started out as an ideological leftist group intent on overthrowing the government and establishing a leftist, Marxist-type regime. And over time, they've mutated and evolved. And so while they still have this sort of leftist revolutionary trapping, they've become as much an organization that's involved in smuggling, drug running as a way to finance their war, as well as in kidnapping for ransom people. So they've kind of moved. Years ago, I might have characterized them as purely a political guerrilla movement. Now they're kind of something else now, because they have this kind of criminal element as well. So, but they've been around for a long time, and President Uribe is certainly not the first Colombian president to have to struggle with the question of what to do with them.
Yeah, the FARC has been around for now more than 40 years.
Right.
So the Colombians, this must, I would have thought this would not be an easy decision for the Colombian government to make, because I would expect, if I was the president of Colombia, I would certainly expect that the government of Ecuador would object to me staging a military raid across my border into their country.
Absolutely. And that's in part why the FARC has established these bases just outside of Colombia, believing that, you know, territorial sovereignty will be respected. And so from the FARC's point of view, this will base, you know, 1 mile in Ecuador is really a smart strategy. And it makes it difficult for the Colombians to do anything about them. So that's, you know, so from their point of view, they're there. And then for the Colombians, it does raise this question of, well, we know you're there. what do we do about you?
And certainly the government of Ecuador knows that the FARC's there too.
Yes, there, and depending on what, there's evidence trickling out that there's some relationship between the government in Ecuador and the FARC, and the extent to which they're actually being supported as opposed to just turning a blind eye, I think is something that we don't have the full picture on yet.
Yeah, that's something I want to make sure we talk about, but it certainly is cloudy, and it seems to be one of those cases where, depending on where you fall on this, if you want, there are people who try to use this to make the case that there are ties between the government of Ecuador and the government of Venezuela and
right.
the FARC, and then there were other people who have looked at that and said, well, you know, we have some serious questions about this. I think even the United States is not so sure, particularly about some of this information that has turned up after this recent raid.
Right. One of the things that was seized in this recent raid, I'm sure you know, is that laptop computer, and a lot has been made about what was found on that laptop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I obviously am not privy to that kind of information, so, you know, I hesitate to say, oh, this definitely proves one way or the other. I think, you know, there's so, and, you know, as you put it well, you know, very cloudy speculation as to exactly what the relationship is. Is it just that President Correa in Ecuador and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela are more ideologically proximate to the FARC, and so they just kind of like them better, or is there something more going on there?
What before this, how would you have described relations between the governments of Colombia and Ecuador?
I wouldn't have described them as terribly good. The three countries, Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, all trade quite a bit with each other. And so in an economic sense, they need each other. At the same time, Uribe is a right-leaning president, maintains good, close ties with the U.S. Correa is not that kind of president. And so I think the two of them, you know, have been willing to have a live and let live type of relationship, but I would not have described their relationship as warm, fuzzy, close before this,
mm-hmm.
which I think is part of why, to answer the question, some of your listeners may be thinking, well, why didn't, you know, President Uribe call up President Correa and say, hey, we know there's a base here. Can we have permission to go and get them?
Because Uribe would have said, or Correa would have said, forget it. We're not going to let you do that.
Right, yeah, we can't let you do that. And, you know, if you really want to believe that the Ecuadorian government supporting the FARC, not only is he going to say, no, you can't come and get them, but he's going to call out the FARC and say, hey, by the way, did you know the Colombian military knows where you are?
Yeah. And in fact, I think that after all of this, one of the things that happened, there was this angry exchange between President Uribe, president of Colombia, and President Correa, the president of Ecuador, where the president of Colombia accused the president of Ecuador of supporting the FARC, and the president of Ecuador called the president of Colombia a liar. And there was this bit of a dust up. So that might indeed tell you something about the relationship between the
right,
two.
Right. Yeah. That you know, I think they both realize they're better off economically working together, but that doesn't mean they have to like each other.
Mm-hmm. So we would certainly expect that one country violates the national border of another by sending troops in to go after guerrillas, as the Colombians did with Ecuador. We would expect that the Ecuadorians would not be happy about this, and they
right.
would object.
Right.
And now the government of Venezuela, led by Hugo Chavez, he weighs in on the side of Ecuador, and so he moves troops on his side of the border.
Mm-hmm.
This is the other side of the country.
Right.
So the question, you know, why would, what's this to, if there's a problem between Colombia and Ecuador, what's this to Hugo Chavez?
Well, this has been, you know, this is a great question, because, you know, this is why I think your kind of geography at the beginning is important, because the Venezuelans shouldn't have been expected to have a stake in this Colombia-Ecuador conflict. It's all completely on the other side of the country from them. And this really reflects, I think, some real long-standing differences and some long-standing dislike between President Chavez of Venezuela and President Uribe of Colombia, that they really are going in opposite directions. And, you know, at times Chavez criticizes Uribe as being a lapdog of the United States and, you know, says, oh, he's, you know, just a U.S. puppet. And the rhetoric gets fairly fiery on both sides of that. So one should not necessarily be surprised that seeing a chance to, you know, criticize his longstanding, I hate to use the word enemy, rival, he seizes it.
Just one more question, and I've got a caller in here I want to bring in. Just because now a couple of times we've heard mentioned the United States, or now you've mentioned the United States.
Right.
It certainly is the case that Colombia and its government would certainly consider to be a friend of the United States,
yes.
Has a positive relationship. But certainly Venezuela is not, Hugo Chavez is not, and Ecuador is not particularly a great friend to the United States. So one wonders... Does the United States in some way, or the way the United States feels about these countries, or the way they feel about the United States, does it somehow get tangled up in this event, or generally in the relationship here now just between these three governments?
It's a hard question to answer, and part of that is that I think even when the U.S. is not actively doing something in Latin America, we often remain the 800-pound gorilla in the corner. And so how things will be perceived by the U.S., what the U.S. might or might not do, may often color decision-making. And in some cases, I think this is a really clear one where the long history of negative relations that the U.S. has had recently with the Chavez government and the sort of the completely opposite positive set of relations we've had with the Colombian government has really sort of helped to sort of crystallize why the U.S. is, you know, a problem in the region. At the same time, the U.S. is a great target and a favorite target of Chavez. And so... I think he sort of really likes taking on the U.S., and he gets a lot of domestic mileage out of criticizing the U.S. anytime he can. And so in some ways, you know, one has to say, you know, he has to have felt, you know, really, you know, this was Christmas for him in the sense that, oh, here I can criticize the U.S. and I can criticize the Colombians all at once and pile on. So I think that's kind of part of what's happening with the U.S. there.
Very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Maria Escobar-Lemon. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University and is interested in Latin American politics. And she has done field research in Colombia, Costa Rica, and Venezuela. And we're talking about this recent crisis that took place earlier this month involving the governments of Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela. What that says about what's going on in those countries, their relationship, something about how that involves the United States, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Line one is our caller to start off here in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Since you raised the U.S. Relationship, I want to sort of bring up something I saw in the papers and on the internet yesterday, and maybe you can comment further about it. It's about the relationship between the U.S. and Colombia in terms of the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement, and Congressman James McGovern, who's a Democrat from the state of Massachusetts, supposedly the hard drive, which you talked about earlier, that was captured by Colombia from Reyes, indicates that he had dealings with a Mr. Jones who also had dealings with this congressman, attempting to set up meetings with FARC and this congressman in Caracas, among other things, to try to stop the fair trade agreement and to also do other things. And indicating some sympathy on the part of the congressman and various other congresspeople through this person, Jones. James C. Jones is the name. It is what they give it, the title they say in the paper, development expert and a former consultant to the United Nations dealing with, and he's someone who's had dealings with FARC. Do you know anything about this report? Have you seen the report?
I have not seen the report.
Do you want me to give you the source of my source for it?
Yes, if you would, please. I haven't seen the report. I do have a comment I want to make about the free trade agreement and that, because that, I think,
right,
plays in there.
Well,
but
this report was cited, let me look online, it's in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and they give some details of the people involved. They have days of they have letters dated October 26th to Mr. Jones, et cetera, et cetera. So you could probably check online, and other people can check online for more details. But it's very interesting to find this sort of relationship on the part of a congressman with, even through intermediaries, with FARC, and attempting to take sides against Uribe and with Chavez, etc.
Right.
And using the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement as, for whatever you want to use it, in terms of FARC sympathizers. So I don't know anything more about it than what I read. And since you're an expert, I thought you might know more.
I apologize for not having seen this report. This is something new that caught me by surprise. The free trade agreement, though, is a controversial topic, much as the debate about NAFTA in the U.S. really caused some significant, people who on the one hand were thrilled about it, really strong advocates, and people who felt, correctly or not, that they would be hurt by it, to strongly oppose it. The moves toward establishing free trade agreements with the U.S. and the region have really met similar fates in many of these countries, and a lot of Latin America has been really quite skeptical about free trade agreements with the U.S. Some of the skepticism, I think, arises from the belief that this is just a U.S. attempt to lock them into some kind of unfavorable terms of trade and to really take advantage of them. Many of them also realize that the free trade agreements are not going to make everybody in their country better off economically, that some people and some sectors are going to win and some are going to lose. And I think the losers are very keenly aware that they might lose. And some of these countries are, looking at what's happened in Mexico and seeing, not everybody's really benefited. And so there's a lot of skepticism about that. So I'm not surprised that there are groups, willing to work with people in the U.S. to try to block something like that from going into place, because they believe that they'll be worse off.
Yeah, but here
as a result,
it's FARC that's being enlisted, and my understanding is that at least from the U.S. point of view, FARC is viewed as terrorists because of their violent behavior,
right,
their links to other terrorists, including Islamic terrorists, Osama bin Laden, etc., and
yes,
and Chavez's links to Iran. So we've got all sorts of national and international interests being involved, and the fact that Congressman McGovern is somehow involved, and maybe others, I don't know. They hint at it in this article, but they don't say more. Seems to be something that's worth looking into.
Yeah, and this is something I definitely do want to follow up on. I apologize for not being able to comment further, but I don't want to make up something and,
yeah,
give you bad information when I don't have anything further to say on that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Again, just to go back to make sure that people understand here what we're talking about. We talked about in the beginning about the thing that precipitated this crisis was this attack by Colombia on guerrillas of the FARC, this more than 40-year-old leftist guerrilla group that had been has been operating all that time in Colombia. They had a base just over the border into Ecuador, so the Colombians went in there to go after these FARC guerrillas. And one of the top FARC leaders, a man named Paul Reyes, was killed, and it is alleged that the Colombians picked up laptops and back to Colombia, and that on them they found a lot of incriminating information, including, according to what I've read, supposedly there was information relating to a cash payment that had been made from the FARC to a political contribution to Rafael Correa, the president of Ecuador, and there was talk about the offer of payment from Hugo Chavez to the FARC and a lot of other stuff. That again, as I've said, some people have looked at this and said, well, we're not so sure. And I guess ultimately a question one would have to ask is to and maybe here I'm engaging in conspiratorial thinking, I don't know, but you have to ask this question, well, to whose interest is it that we have information that discredits the FARC, that discredits Hugo Chavez, that discredits the president of Ecuador? I mean, you know, who might be interested in having that kind of information come out about all of these people and their relationships with one another?
Well, and the Colombians obviously have a strong interest in showing that there is some kind of linkage between the governments of Venezuela and Ecuador and the FARC. That benefits them tremendously, especially in terms of international public opinion and getting other countries to put pressure on them to stop supporting the FARC, to make it more difficult for them to use these external bases and such. So I think the Colombians benefit tremendously from that. In the same conspiratorial thinking vein, some elements within the U.S. would say the U.S. government would benefit from this.
Well, I guess I would expect that some people would say, well, that the United States if the United States was involved in this, it would make sense if they're trying to help Colombia,
right.
They were trying to do something that would support the government of Colombia, and you know they wouldn't mind doing something to make Hugo Chavez look bad, and
right.
You know if you want to go that way, you could say, well, that's I guess you could imagine such a thing happening,
right? And we also have to remember that there are a significant number of relatively high-profile hostages being held by the FARC. I don't know if you had wanted to go here or not.
Well, that's also interesting because that also brings in Hugo Chavez, because he's been involved in trying to work out a deal with the FARC for release of some of these people.
Right. And I have tremendous sympathy and cannot imagine what the families of these people who have been kidnapped and are being held by the FARC are going through. Some of these people have been held for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you thought someone could help you get your loved one released, I can see how you might be willing to turn to just about anybody to help you do that. And so if you thought this congressman might have some chance of being able to intercede where other people had failed, you might want to go to him. Chavez has won the release of several hostages. The FARC turned over four people on one occasion and two on another in Venezuela, and there have been ongoing efforts to get them to release the former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of that in the background too, that I think that you have people operating at many different levels, some of whom may be well-connected individuals acting in sort of a private sense to try to win the release of friends, family,
yeah,
and such from the FARC.
I have calls. I want to get right to them. I promise these people I'm not going to make them wait. We're at our midpoint here. Just one real quick question here now. After the crisis that we talked about, other governments in Latin America really got together and really said to them, each other and to the parties involved, look, this is something we've got to settle. We can't let this get out of hand.
Right.
And indeed, the leaders of the three countries did come together. They shook hands. It's supposedly President Uribe apologized to President Correa on behalf of the government of Colombia, said, no, I'm very sorry we did this. It's never going to happen again. And everybody shook hands and was smiling. So then the question is, well, is this really over?
It's in everybody's interest, I think, to make it look like it's over. The Venezuelans had done some things to suspend trade while this crisis was in effect, and so it was in their economic interest to get trade restored. It was in the Colombians' interest to settle this, especially as the OAS had condemned their actions. And I think it's also in the interest of the Venezuelans and the Ecuadorians to not have too many more questions be asked about what their relationship with the FARC is.
Hmm.
If they truly have nothing to hide, then more light is not necessarily a problem, But if they really can't prove definitively they're not involved, or they are involved, then turning attention away from that really benefits them. And I don't want to at all say I think they're involved or not. It's sometimes really hard to prove you're not doing anything.
Our guest in this hour, Maria Escobar-Lemon. She is an associate professor of political science at Texas A&M University College, and has been for some time follows the politics of Latin America, particularly some of the countries that we're talking about here. And we're talking a little about this diplomatic crisis that happened a little earlier this month involving Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Champaign next. Line 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, the three countries in the dispute were once unified as one nation under the Grand Colombia, very briefly in the 1820s, right after independence. I was wondering if that common heritage is ever part of the rhetoric, especially in Venezuela, to explain what looks like a hostile action from the outside, either explicitly, does Chavez ever mention the common Bolivarian heritage of the three, or is there ever a sense that it's less radical, it appears less radical in Venezuela, because after all, Bolivar once famously crossed the Andes to liberate Colombia from Spain. Does it look less radical too?
You probably know, the Simón Bolívar has become a major icon of Chavez's independence movement, and so, you know, he changed the name of the country to the Bolivarian Republic and is really intent on invoking this image of Simón Bolívar as the liberator, and has really rekindled interest in. I saw a report essentially referring to, you know, he's reawakened this cult of Bolívar in Venezuela. Now, that doesn't mean that Bolivar's not an important figure in other countries. He's an important figure in all these countries. And yes, all three of them were briefly united as Gran Colombia. Ironically, most of the speculation about what Bolivar and the former unification really meant is that many people have said, and I'm not one of them, but I remember hearing some Colombians speculate that, you know, we're a little nervous about all this talk about Bolivar because, you know, we're worried that Chavez is going to try to reunify everybody underneath him. And so
Bolivar himself was doing, yeah.
Right. And so there's that kind of tension, I think, in Colombia that Venezuela might be, you know, looking for, you know, Chavez, not Venezuela, but Chavez might be looking for a way to try to unify everybody. And so I don't think they would see this attempt, the incursion into Ecuador by the Colombians, as part of this unifying strategy. And I saw another report that was out that, realizing that this sort of rhetoric of Bolivar has actually become an important debating point, if you will, Uribe has also started referring to him in his speeches and talking about the way in which that, yes, he's a grand figure, but he wasn't about liberating people from Spain to dominate them himself.
Yeah.
So I think Bolivar comes into play as this important iconic figure. But that the chances, you know, that this is really about attempting to unify these countries politically is really, really small. And that if they're going to get unified in any way, they're going to just build tighter and tighter economic relations, because they all have a lot to gain from trading with each other.
Right, right. So it's just interesting how that common heritage can become part of the rhetoric, and I don't think most people outside the three countries are aware of that.
Right. No, it is. It's really the whole sort of, I think probably the best way to put it is sort of the who owns Bolivar's legacy in terms of, you know, doing what would Bolivar do if he were here type of legacy is really, it's an interesting debate, and Chavez very much wants to paint himself as the heir to Bolivar's legacy.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
Next,
thank you.
Next caller is in Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to pick up on David's point of examining sources and being somewhat skeptical. I think in this report from the Wall Street Journal of an American congressman dealing with the FARC to block the trade agreement, one has to first of all see that it's a single paper and that it's one of Rupert Murdoch's papers. And I'd certainly like to see a couple more sources on this before I would take it with the greatest of confidence.
Well, I will agree with you. I would like to see. I'd like to see more about this. I've pulled up the Wall Street Journal article, mm-hmm. and it's intriguing, but it doesn't provide the kind of detail one might be craving, and that I think the initial caller really was hoping that I had to mm-hmm. provide. And like many people who follow events, I'd like to know a lot more about, you know, what they found on this laptop that supposedly is, you know, such important proof.
Well, you're certainly not alone.
No, and I suspect, you know, there are people, I'm sure, who do know what's on this, but this is kind of a case of where I feel like we're all getting enough information to be teased, mm-hmm. but not enough information to really feel that we have the whole picture.
There seems to be a campaign. I got an email this morning, in fact, where there seems to be a rather virulent attack upon Chavez, such as he is. This was based on his apparently acquiring an arms plant to manufacture Kalashnikovs mm-hmm. from the Russians, but then going on to assert that the next thing he would get would be missiles and all sorts of warheads. Seemed a vague inference that he would soon have chemical, biological weapons aimed at the United States. And this is pretty wild. Claims.
I too am extremely skeptical of claims like that. But then, you know, I remember reading the paper a while ago that Chavez had people in Venezuela convinced the U.S. was on the point of invading, and so he was forming citizen militias to fight the U.S. invaders off at the shore.
Well, it's not an altogether wild claim, because we've done it often.
Right, we have done it. But the sort of, one has to remember, I think, with Chavez especially, that he's playing to multiple audiences, and you know, he's playing to the domestic audience, and he gets a lot of public opinion boost whenever he, you know, looks like he's the tough guy standing up to the U.S., and he gets a lot of mileage at home out of that. And then, you know, he gets mileage out of that internationally among disaffected leftists within the region, both those who hold office, but, you know, the people who vote for them, who've been dissatisfied with the way things in the region are, who look with admiration at what's happening in Venezuela. And so I think anything he can do that makes him look stronger, increases his international prestige, or makes him look like a serious force to be reckoned with, you know, he gains value of. So the, you know, statement of, oh, we might acquire these, even if he's not actively working to do so, I think he gets a value out of actually just making that statement.
Well, I don't know that he made the statement. I don't think he did. It was the person writing the email that inferred that this was coming. I think we probably both agree that he's somewhere between a demagogue and a populist. And he certainly plays the media for all it's worth.
Yes.
But this is an election year. And I shouldn't be too surprised to see all sorts of claims coming out of this country.
Right.
Claiming that he's a threat to our security. And obviously, Venezuela isn't a threat to our security. It may be a problem, at least for some. But they're not going to march into the United States.
The bigger threat Venezuela poses to the U.S. has to do with the supply of oil and continuing to supply us with oil, depending on when you look at it, they are the fourth or fifth largest supplier of oil to the U.S. So we import a lot of oil from Venezuela. So in many ways, I mean, that's our tie with them. So, you know, if oil production falls significantly in Venezuela, that hurts the U.S. much more than some of these other things that, that Venezuela could do to us.
So that's I'm glad you touched on that point, because I was sitting here thinking, well obviously we could spend an entire hour just talking about Venezuela and relationship between Venezuela and the United States. But to get at this this question, why should there be this tension, and who benefits, and particularly, well, what is important about as far as the United States? If you're only going to view it through the lens of the United States, the question, why does Venezuela matter? It sounds like that probably is the number one, other than, you know, we're interested in general security and stability in Latin America. But the big thing is that, as you say, Venezuela provides a lot of oil to the United States. And even though we have this fractious, difficult relationship between the two governments, Venezuela continues to supply a lot of oil to the United States.
Right. Venezuela continues to supply a lot of oil to us. And that the oil relationship is a major reason why, you know, the why we should care about Venezuela is the oil relationship is one of the two big ones. And the other big one has to do with it that Chavez, whether we like him or not, he is a mover, leader among in terms of public opinion on the left side of the political spectrum in Latin America. And so, you know, he will sway people who are on the fence about things. So, you know, we need to care about Venezuela from that point of view, but the situation with oil there is really a big issue, and it's part of Chavez's power base.
Our guest is Maria Escobar Lemon. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University and follows politics in Latin America. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next up is someone here in Champaign County where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. A curious irony is about oil is that Colombia and Venezuela are working together. I don't know whether it's going anywhere. The U.S. is opposing it, but they're talking about a pipeline going to the Pacific so that Venezuela can send its oil to China, which would be, I guess the U.S. would see that as a threat to the Monroe Doctrine as construed through the decades. But the laptop, the only journalist that I saw that actually had any text from it was Greg Palast, who is a American who works for BBC, and he says that the 300 million was entirely misconstrued. It was 300 hostages that was talked to. There was no noun after the 300. One must remember when one talks about dealing with the FARC that Venezuela's Chavez was authorized by Uribe and Colombia to talk to try to get some hostages released.
Right.
They did get some hostages released. And it was only when Chavez started talking directly to the Colombian military, apparently, at least that's the story. I don't know if that's the substance of why it was scotched. It might have been U.S. pressure, and that was a pretext. But that was the story, was that Uribe didn't like Chavez going around his authority, his office, and talking directly to Colombian generals about some kind of resolution to the hostage release. So it seems that everyone refers to this information, but it's just an allegation. And the only source that I've seen that has the text says that it's more than ambiguous. It's likely not doesn't have anything to do with money. Now, talking to the FARC, as we say, this story that I heard, I haven't looked at the Wall Street Journal text, but the idea that opposition to free trade, you know, this guy Jones, who is opposed to free trade, who might have talked to the FARC in some capacity, because McGovern is talking to him, that makes him a supporter of FARC? That's ridiculous. That's like saying anybody who's supporting, opposed to the free trade agreement is a terrorist. That's the syllogism that I would see that incorporates. So that's bogus, but that's what this government likes to do, is to say you're either with us or against us, right?
And the situation with the FARC is really, you're absolutely right, that it's a very complex situation, because people need to be, many people need people to be able to talk to them because they're trying to get the release of hostages done. And the Colombians have tried periodically negotiating with them to actually negotiate a complete settlement to hostilities, to sort of, if you resolve the problem once and for all, if you will. And periodically, they attempts have been made to do big prisoner releases and hostage exchanges and such. So, for all those kind of things to happen, you have to be, you know, you have to have someone who can deal with them. But the FARC's not a country; they don't have a government in the sense that there's not, you know, you can look in, you know, government directory and phone up, you know, we don't need to talk to you, you know, exchange ministers of state. So you have to have these kind of other people who can act as intermediaries and go-betweens, and those kind of people are connected people who know a lot of people.
So the guy who was killed was one of their major negotiators, Ruiz, if I recall correctly. So he was obviously the one that people would have been talked to. As far as U.S. role in the area, their allegation is made that the La Manta base, which is soon to be losing its lease in Ecuador, and that Correa says, well, you can keep it here if we can have one in Miami, says that that was implicated not just in the satellite phone intercept, but also in the facilitating the raid. So U.S. Is not an even-handed broker, as it were. Thanks.
All right. Well, let's go on and talk to somebody else here in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Following what the previous caller said regarding to the conversations that the FARC has with different countries. Nobody has mentioned that the FARC has conversations with France, for example, towards the release of Ingrid Betancourt. And also, 10 years ago, the U.S. had a meeting in Costa Rica and met Reyes with some representatives of the U.S. Congress. I think it's very important, and I'm going to ask the caller, the presenter, something regarding to that. First of all, one of the major problems that we have related to the United States and some of the Latin American countries is to put the FARC under the list of terrorist organizations. A lot of the Latin American countries don't agree on that. And secondly, to understand the situation in the region, especially Ecuador, Venezuela, and Colombia, it is very important to look how much money the U.S. government is giving to Colombia through the Plan Colombia. We have 8 years of Plan Colombia in Colombia. One of the interests of Colombia and the U.S. is to regionalize the conflict, especially with Ecuador, especially regarding what the previous caller talked about, the military U.S. base in Manta in Ecuador, which is going to be closed in next year. The U.S. gives to the government of Uribe, has given in the last years $5.5 billion. And we have like $3 million per year to the planning assistance of training U.S. soldiers, helping, training Colombian soldiers by U.S. soldiers. And after 4 years of Plan, 8 years of Plan Colombia, the cocaine remains to 600 tons a year. So that is very important to understand what's going on in Colombia, to understand what is the reaction of the other countries when a country is invaded, violated by others. By other country, in this case, Colombia. So I would like to the presenter talk about Plan Colombia and what it means for the region regarding to the attitudes of nationalist attitudes that Venezuela has and Ecuador has. And yes, thank you.
Yes, I think that the caller makes an excellent point because, as she says, the United States government has put a lot of money into Colombia, has given a lot of money to the government of Colombia and other kinds of assistance. The big reason is illegal drugs,
right?
To try to prevent their production and then eventual export into the United States. And I suppose also people would say, well, you know, given our interest in that region and the fact that Venezuela and Ecuador are not necessarily our big friends, that we also want to have somebody who we can count on to represent our interests, or some, you know, a friend at least in that region, and Colombia is that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the origin of the caller's absolutely correct that Plan Colombia has really had a big influence in Colombia, and the U.S. has through it funneled a tremendous amount of money to the Colombian government as a way to help them. And it originally started out as not just a war on drugs money. It was really conceived of as broader efforts to engage in some economic revitalization as a way to try to convince farmers to stop growing coca and start growing other things. So you'd essentially begin to dry up the supply. You'd begin to break some of the links that the FARC and other, I'll just call them violent armed groups, had in the country by, you know, completely removing this potential source of income for them, and to then beef up and help the Colombian military. So it wasn't just about military. It wasn't all about military training at first. But since the plan went into effect under the previous president's administration under Andrés Pastrana, a lot of money has been spent in Colombia, and it shored up support for Ribes. It's definitely provided him with support, and I think he's gotten some mileage, not just from that collaboration, but from the fact that he's starting to get some of the benefits in military terms from this investment in training and technology that the Colombian military has gotten. So he started to get some military successes because of it.
Against the FARC.
Right. Now, the Plan Colombia was also supposed to help by sort of with the drying up of the supply, dealing with armed paramilitary groups in the country, which has had really no effect on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, though, underscoring what the caller said, if we want to look at the relationship between these three countries, it is certainly complicated by the fact that I'm sure in Venezuela and Ecuador, they see Colombia as being a client state of the United States.
Yes. And it's an extension of some of the suspicion with which U.S. anti-drug efforts in much of Latin America are viewed. And in part, they're viewed with suspicion, I think, not just in Colombia but elsewhere, because it's, well, if this is something that bothers you, why don't you do something about it in your country rather than coming to our country? And so the controversial aspect is the aerial fumigation, that's going to kill off things besides cocaine or the coca plants. And so there's some broader suspicion, but yeah, you're right that it does help sort of draw the lines clearly of, to use popular rhetoric, who's with us and who's against us.
Just again, as I said, we've got about a minute or two left. We could have talked about any one of these three countries. We could have just talked about that. Just going back to Venezuela for a second, Hugo Chavez certainly has his challenges at home taking care of domestic issues, and certainly their reaction to him in his own country is somewhat polarized. He certainly has supporters and he has detractors. How are we going to expect, though, that Chavez is going to be around for the foreseeable future, no matter how it is you feel about him?
Yeah, I think for better or for worse, we're kind of stuck with him for at least a while. Until the Venezuelan people turn on him, I think we're stuck with him. The sort of best route to getting him out is kind of to leave him alone and let the price of oil fall. And that is really what, I mean, he's got a lot of money that he can throw around and keep his supporters happy with promises of free medical clinics, social services, food type of distribution programs. And all of that requires a lot of money. And so, you know, if you don't like Chavez, the best thing that can happen to get rid of him is let the price of oil fall. He won't be able to afford it now. Is that going to happen? You got to get someone else on to ask that question.
Yeah.
But no, we're kind of stuck with him for a while. The opposition is somewhat disorganized, and there really is no middle left in Venezuela. There's the love Chavez, hate Chavez.
And anything I don't know. We actually talked all that much about Ecuador. Any last thing you want to say, particularly about Ecuador?
No, there's not so much. I mean, it's unfortunate that they really think that that in some ways they ended up sort of, despite the fact that they were the ones whose territory was violated, they really ended up looking kind of like a little pawn in this. I mean, it really became, you know, Chavez and Uribe talking about resolving this, not Correa and Uribe, when it really was a bilateral conflict. And some of that, I think, is emblematic of the leadership sort of stance that Chavez plays with the left in the region. And that's something that we do have to keep in mind, that, you know, he's going to insert himself in these situations because of that.
So this was really, you're saying that this is really much more about Colombia and Venezuela than it is about Colombia and Ecuador, even though Ecuador was the country who said, well, look, our national sovereignty has been violated here, and that's serious, and you would expect any country to object to something like
right,
that.
Right, and you would have expected anybody to object, but then you would have expected the conflict to be between Ecuador and Colombia, and very quickly the news story became what Chavez was doing, what Chavez was saying, as opposed to, you know, Ecuador very much got painted the victim in this, and then kind of, you know, oh, poor Ecuador, they got violated.
Well, and is that the case if you look at, say, Latin American media? Or I guess I'm thinking about the fact, particularly if you look at how this was covered in American media, it would be natural for the focus to be on Venezuela and this difficult relationship between Chavez and the Bush administration.
Right. And my sense from looking at the Colombian media was well, Chavez got a lot of attention, and the, you know, he has no business doing his stuff, but the Colombian media really doesn't like him, and they routinely take swipes at him. I mean, the Colombian newspapers frequently refer to him as a dictator or a caudillo. So, you know, they, I think all the Colombians used it as, the Colombian media used it as a chance to turn on him as well.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sure we will be talking about this part of the world again, but for the moment, we're going to leave it. Our guest is Maria Escobar-Lemon. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University, College Station, Texas. Professor Escobar-Lemon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information available online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay with us, though. More coming up in the way of news and sports and weather and other things, and an interview in the 1 o'clock hour, all part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. The interview in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today will be with writer and critic Richard Zoglin. We'll talk with him about his book, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. That'll follow the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 10.83 and a quarter, down 35 and three quarters. In Chicago, May wheat 10.46 and a half, make that a quarter, down 21 and a quarter. July 10.47 and a half, down 21. May corn 5.49 and three quarters, up 5. July 5.62, up 5. September 5.66 and a half, up 6 and a half. December 5.65 and a half, up 5 and 3 quarters. May beans 13.43 and 3 quarters, make that 13.44, up 37. July 13.57 and a half, up 35 and a half. August 13.15, up 34. November 12.46 and 3 quarters, up 7 and 3 quarters. May meal 3.53.10, up 2.80. May oil 58.30, up 53. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle 90.15, down $1. June 89.92 and a half, make that 89.95, down 90. April feeder cattle 102.52.